Blog Talk Radio.
Texas on Thursday, July 25th, day number 206 of 2013. Before I go any further, you know, it's late Central Time, 9 o'clock Central Time, but it's already July 26th in England. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about England tonight with a new baby in the royal family, but I say July 26th because a very special man celebrates number 70 today, and that's Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones. So he's probably waking up in London right now, or pretty soon, having a little bit of coffee and maybe getting some gifts. So happy birthday to Mick Jagger, who is 70 years old this year. Tonight we're going to be talking to Leslie Eastman. She's back after a few weeks off, and we're also going to be hearing from Barry Jacobson. We're going to be talking about this new royal baby in the UK, and what does that mean? The history of it is very interesting. I mean, we just think of the baby, but there's a lot of history behind that baby and behind that family, and we're going to be getting into that as well. You know, the city of Detroit, we've done a couple of shows about the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit is going bankrupt or declaring bankruptcy, I guess, whatever the right term is. Well, both Leslie and Barry have very personal memories of Detroit. So we're going to be hearing from them tonight as we talk about the city of Detroit. And of course, there's a little scandal in San Diego that Leslie is going to be telling us about. So all of that will be happening tonight on our show. It should be a great show. My book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, available in print, available in Kindle. You can go to the website and get yourself a personal copy. You can do that, and we'll be more than happy to dedicate the book to you. Last week, I got a personal request from a man who had a very fond memory of his Spanish teacher in high school, who was a Cuban. And he said, well, I got to get this book for my old Spanish teacher. And he did, and I dedicated the book. And I'm sure that the teacher was, I'm sure, pretty happy when he got the copy. So CubanosInWisconsin.com, check it out. I think you're going to enjoy the book. You know, we have a new friend of the show this month, and I'm talking about a company in the Northwest called Ranger Self Defense. They do a lot of services for your personal self-defense, for your family, and I want you to hear a little bit about them. This is Ranger Self Defense, and I want you to hear from the owner, Mr. Cardwell. So we're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from Ranger Self Defense. And I want you to support this company. They do a lot of good stuff and provide you with a lot of very important stuff for yourself.
Let's face it, this world can now be a very crazy place with a lot of crazy people. More violent crimes are occurring now than ever before in history. It's a fact. So how can you assure yourself and your family of safety and security whether you're in your home or on the streets? It's very simple. You have to be equipped with the very best in self-defense and security products. At RangerSelfDefense.com, we can help. We offer a wide variety of the highest quality, most trusted names in self-defense accessories and home security systems. You'll find stun guns, pepper spray, and more. Everything you need to stop an attacker in his tracks. And nowadays, essential, especially for women and children. For your home, you'll feel safer with DIY home security systems, hidden cameras, pool alarms, and a wide variety of other products. All purchases are discreet and backed by a no-questions-asked 90-day money-back guarantee. Don't delay another minute. Protect yourself and your family today at RangerSelfDefense.com. That's RangerSelfDefense.com.
Thank you. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let me say hello to Leslie Eastman. How are you, Leslie?
Good, Silvio. Happy to be with you once again.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the show. And you've got quite a few things we're going to be talking about tonight. Let me say hello to Barry Jacobson, who's also on the line. How are you, Barry?
Good evening, Silvio, and to your listening audience.
I thought you were going to say good evening, Silvio, and to Queen Leslie.
That's the goddess Leslie.
Goddess Leslie, okay. I always get queen and goddess confused, Leslie, but I think you know what I mean.
It really depends what my mood is.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. That's the key. Well, I got to bring something up here, my friend Barry, because you're my military historian, thanks to Leslie introduced us, and you're my military historian. But I gotta ask you about something that happened on this day in history in 1945. President Truman was visiting with Stalin, and he sort of hinted at the possibility that there was this terrible bomb that we could be using. And what do you think Stalin's – I don't know if there's any recollections of what Stalin was thinking, but do you know of any?
I don't. I can imagine that Stalin, who had at his disposal the future KGB, it was called the NKVD back then, but he had an amazing intelligence service and it completely infiltrated the Third Reich. I imagine he had some inkling what was going on. Certainly, several of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project were communists. I don't know how much it leaked to the Stalin regime, but I'm sure he had some inkling what was going on.
Yeah, well, but of course, just a couple of weeks later, the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima. But I just thought it was interesting that would be going on this day in history. Well, we got three topics we want to get into tonight, guys, and the first one is all Leslie. So we're going to let Leslie swing away at this first topic, but you have a mayor in San Diego, Leslie, who is, I guess, misbehaving. Is that the right word? Would you describe him that way? And I thought maybe you could fill us in on the mayor of your city, interesting guy. So fill us in a little bit. Take a few minutes and tell us about the mayor of your city.
Well, it's a bad week for your city when your mayor is featured on all the comedy channels and you have more drama per square inch politically than New York City. The only thing we are lacking right now is sexting, but other than that, we have a complete sex scandal and a very narcissistic, power-hungry mayor who will not give up power willingly of his own volition. So it is going to be lots of interesting political drama in America's finest city for the next several weeks.
Yes, and he's a Democrat. He's a Democrat, right? I believe he's a Democrat.
As was pointed out to me very, very ably on Legal Insurrection, I'm writing the RS Professor Jacobson is in Israel much more consistently for the next couple of weeks and featuring Mayor Schillner's antics, as I do. We need to remember to identify him as a Democrat because, a lot of the conservatives, a lot of Republicans, they're identified by their party in all the media. And it's amazing how often the Democrats will circle the wagon when one of their own comes under some sort of scandal. And this particular instance of sexual harassment is so egregious and so appalling to most people that it's drawn the attention of elite Democrats in our state and city, and they've asked for Mayor Bob Filmer's resignation. So right now, the mayor is in complete meltdown, but that being said, he's got a personality such that I personally believe he'll not be leaving office unless there is a legal mechanism to get rid of him.
Yeah. Well, you're probably right, because he would have to be, I don't know how they do it in cities, I guess he would have to resign. That would be the honorable thing to do, but people like that are not very... They're usually not very honorable to begin with.
Yeah. You have instances where both Republicans and Democrats have resigned under scandal, but Bob Filner has been notorious with his poor treatment for women. In fact, I myself had covered this topic some time ago when I started my Tea Party activism in 2009, where I recounted evidence that he was having a relationship with somebody from another website. But that being said, not married, and Washington, D.C. is Washington, D.C. I didn't realize he was going to bring it to San Diego, along with his sense of fair play and compromise. He's gotten into confrontations with our city attorney, Jan Goldsmith. And interestingly enough, Jan Goldsmith, who would normally be poised to defend the mayor from charges, has to have to recuse himself from any involvement in this case. And the good thing for the taxpayers of the city is that Bob Filner is going to have to put his own legal, protection and hire his own lawyers for the cases that are upcoming. And indeed, several press conferences this week, Gloria Allred, the notorious celebrity attorney, was acting on behalf of the first client, Irene McCormick Jackson, who described a lot of 50 Shades of Grey style abuse that she got as the director of communications under Bob Filner. And she's the first, and since I posted that piece, six other women have come forward. So now Bob Filner has a team of seven women who are accusing him of some sort of sexual harassment.
Wow. But see, Leslie, I knew that it would be exciting the night you came back. And it is.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a great. We've got this great.
I knew when I was going on vacation that some big story would be breaking, and sure enough, the mayor went on meltdown. And that's the sad part about this too, Silvio. He was doing a few things some of my Tea Party people like. He was definitely doing things, shall we say, on more independent, libertarian basis, some, not all, but some, that had won the approval of some Tea Party people. So, though he wasn't going to be the stalwart small government, champion, another candidate might have been, at least he had the potential to be a decent mayor. And he has let the power go to his head and apparently has a history of treating women who are beholden to him in some way as some sort of Karen slave girl. And, have enforced his attentions inappropriately on, as I said, seven women have come forward to accuse him, and all very consistently, too. And the first press conference featured the new top new styles, the Filner dance and the Filner headlock. So, it's pretty appalling.
And when we thought San Diego was just this quiet little city in Southern California, exciting little city this week, to say the least. But I'll tell you what, we've got another thing to get into, and that is a new baby in London. And you mentioned today, Leslie and Barry, we'll get you in. You mentioned something about his name. What is the baby's name? I don't know. Tell me what the baby's name is.
Well, I'll go first. It's George Alexander Lewis, and Barry will get into the definitive reasons why they named him. I myself personally feel that between the disc that iPod that Obama sent with his speeches to the Queen and the general disrespect he has shown the royal family in England as a whole, that based on Obama's distaste for George W. Bush, they called their baby George just to spite Obama. But Barry says that my thinking is not entirely correct, and I'll let Barry explain.
Well,
okay. Barry, let me just say one thing very quickly. You believe Leslie, that there is a international dimension, a foreign policy dimension to the naming of this little baby, right?
No.
Okay.
No,
okay.
I did not.
All right, good. Well, Barry, tell me about it.
The royal families have only a certain number of names that they can use. These are known as dynastic names. And every royal house has a handful that they can use. In England, the dynastic names are basically any of the names that have come previously. And after, you know, centuries, they've become fairly solidified. So they're very little variation. And that's why you have a Henry VIII and a George V, et cetera. It's because they keep naming these kings the same dynastic names. So with the royal family of England, for instance, you have William, as in William the Conqueror, and then you have William I, William II, and III, and William IV. And then you have a Henry, and you have 8 Henrys all total. And you have George, which is, we've had 5 Georges. Then you have Charles. We had 2 Charles and 2 James, 2 Richards, and only 1 John, because we all know how good that turned out when they named one of them John. That was the famous Prince John of Robin Hood fame. He became King John, one of England's worst kings. No other king has ever been named John since. So you only have those names to pick from. So the prince's name is George. He'll be George VI. George VII. There were 6 Georges. So George VII. His great-grandfather was George VI during World War II. Alexander, and honestly, I'm not sure where that quite came from, what member of the family that came from. Louis is in homage to Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was Prince Charles's godfather. And, of course, he's Earl of Cambridge, or the Prince of Cambridge, because his father is the Duke of Cambridge. So there you have it. He has those names. He's George Alexander Louis of Cambridge.
Wow.
And by the way, my personal favorite would have been Edward. I wish it was Edward the Ninth, but I guess not.
Yeah. Now, Barry, I'd like you to maybe take us back a little bit. You did a little bit with the names. But if we could just take a few minutes and first of all, why this family? Where did this royalty line, if you will, where did this begin? And if you just kind of give us a little history of this family, because obviously everybody knows Elizabeth, everybody knows her father, but I don't know too much before that. So just kind of give us a little history of the royal family. When did it start? And just kind of give us a little history.
All right. Well, loosely speaking, this royal family can trace its ancestry back clear to 1066 and William the Conqueror. William the Conqueror is the Duke of Normandy who leads his army across the Channel for northern France and conquers Anglo-Saxon England. He's William the First, and we begin dating kings then in 1066 with William the First. That dynasty is called the Norman Dynasty, and then it's followed 4 kings later by the Angevin Dynasty, which is related matrilineally to the mother to the Norman Dynasty. And that's the way it will go. It will go all through the centuries. It will sometimes change dynasties. It will go from Norman to Angevin or Plantagenet, as it's also called, from Plantagenet to Tudor, from Tudor to the Stuarts to Hanovers, which is what we have today. They're called the House of Windsor, but they actually originally were the Hanovers, Saxe-Hanover. But they're always related, usually through either the mother, father, or cousin. The way succession works is normally through the father, but if there's not a direct link, a direct heir from the father, you go to a heir through the mother or from a cousin that's the next in line, as these things go. What happened with this particular family, the Hanovers, was that around 1720, the Stuart dynasty came to an end when Queen Anne died without any children. And, of course, the Stuarts were a Scottish family that was related as cousins to the Tudors. And when Elizabeth died without children, James I, became king. That became the Stuart dynasty about the 17th century. So the Hanovers are Germans. They come from northern Germany. And they changed their name to the House of Windsor during World War I because there was such anti-German animosity running rampant through England that they went from being the House of Hanover, Saxe-Hanover, and actually Saxe-Coburg-Hanover because Prince Albert, who was Queen Victoria's husband, was from Saxe-Coburg. And then they became the House of Windsor because that was their primary residence, the Castle of Windsor at the time. And so now they're known as the Windsors, but they've also taken the name of Montbatten as well as part of the royal name. But essentially, they're the same dynasty that's ruled since William the Conqueror, changing only when there was no direct line and instead a cousin would come in. But they do have, you know, they have drops of blood of everybody from William the Conqueror all the way up until today, with Queen Elizabeth II.
Wow. Wow. Now, I was thinking, and Leslie, if you have a question, go ahead. But I just had a very quick question about this little baby who was born. What a different world. What a different England, if I could put it that way, he will be the king of. I mean, I'm assuming he'll be the king, what, 40, 50 years? Maybe sooner. I don't know. He's got a young father, right?
Yeah, I mean, and he's not even first next in line. His father, Prince Charles, will be king first for, you know, who knows how long. And it's a very long-lived family. They notoriously live very long. So who knows? We probably will not be alive when this prince becomes king.
Well, but I was thinking, let's say 50 years. Let's say he becomes king, sometime 2060 or something like that when he's a – when he's a 50-year-old man, and that would make William a man in his 80s. I mean, let's just say 50 years from now, the 2060, that he becomes king. More than likely, yeah, you're right, we're not going to be around. But I was thinking about how different the England that he was born into was, let's say, to the England that his grandmother, Elizabeth, was born into. I mean, it's a much different country now than it was 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. I mean, the population demographics are different. The country is different. It's not the same military power that it was when his grandmother was became queen in 1952. I mean, in 1952, England was, very much of an international military power. It still is, but certainly not to the same degree. So it is going to be a very different world. And I don't know, he may not want to be king when he figures that out, Barry.
Well, there's a couple things there, and I'd like to talk about one of them, which you didn't bring up, which is really a need for a monarchy. But there are 54 Commonwealth nations, and depending on whether the Commonwealth lasts or not, he will grow up to become the head of state of 54 nations, and directly the head of state of 19 of those. I mean, he's the queen presides directly over 19 of those Commonwealth nations, where she opens their parliament, et cetera. That's a lot. I mean, it's a very significant role. And what the monarch does in England, the role they play, I think is an important one and a valuable one. You know, a lot of people think of the monarchy as sort of an anachronism, and in fact, an expensive anachronism, and, you know, shrug their shoulders and say, why bother? Why they do this? But I think the people in America especially don't understand the value of monarchy. First of all, the monarch in England pays for itself. They do get stipends from the government, but when you add up the tourist revenue derived directly from activities revolving around the monarchy, it more than pays for itself. It's actually in the black, not in the red. Not to mention the royal family is very wealthy and pays for a lot of its own maintenance out of its own pocket. But when you get to the duties of a royal, including this young prince who's going to grow up a royal, they're constantly encumbered with ceremony and duty. It is not a freewheeling lifestyle at all. They do essentially what the vice president of the United States does. If you think of what Joe Biden does, which is go to state funerals, open various sessions of, you know, the Senate or whatever, they do it not in just one country like Joe Biden does. They do it for 54 countries. The entire ceremonial role of the president and vice president of the United States is separated in the British system and given to the monarch. And instead, the prime minister does the politics. The prime minister does the direct, you know, governing and leaves all the ceremonial and head of state role to the king or members of the royal family. And what that allows England to have and other nations with monarchies to have, such as Spain or Thailand, the Scandinavian countries, is a single family or person in the royal family, in the monarch, who is above politics. And that's an important role. Somebody who's not one party or the other. You know, in America, or even in England, we're talking about the prime minister. If you're the party out of power, then you're constantly badgering and belittling the power of the party that's in power, or the president or the prime minister. There's always sniping at each other across the aisles. And politics sullies everything. And in England, that the royal family is above all that. It's the one person who unifies the queen, or the royals for that matter, unifies the entire country. And can I give you, do I have a moment here to give you an example of how?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I think that would be good. Yeah.
I was in Thailand in the army in 1985. My team had deployed to Thailand to assist the Thai army in interdicting drug trafficking in the northern part of that country, the so-called Golden Triangle. We landed in Bangkok, and we spent that evening having a good old time and then went to bed. And when we woke up at noon the next day, which was not a training day, it was a Saturday morning in Bangkok, there were tanks on the streets. And the military had had a coup overnight. We woke up to find military checkpoints at every block with tanks, soldiers, armored cars. We were locked down in our hotel. No one could travel. The airports were closed. And the prime minister had been arrested by the troops, by the colonels. And democracy in Thailand was suspended. The military did not like what the prime minister was doing or his policies, and they had overthrown the prime minister. Now, if this was a normal, you know, democrat country, you might have ended up with a military junta in charge, like you saw in Greece or in many South American countries. Instead, that evening, the king of Thailand, who, by the way, is a direct descendant of the king from the, you know, the movie and the play and so on, the King and I, the king got on the national radio and national television, and he broadcast to the whole country. And he said to the military, go home, go back to your barracks. We're not going to do this. And the military stood down. The troops went back, the colonels released the prime minister, and democracy was restored. And it was restored because they had such respect for the king.
Well, you may remember another episode about another king in Spain when Franco was... King Juan Carlos, who turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to Spanish democracy. When Juan Carlos, when Franco died, he really pretty much, you know, directed the country from a dictatorship to a democracy. Now, they've got problems now, but at least in the late 70s and in 1980s, King Juan Carlos was very essential for the country. But I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a little break. And then, is there anything, Leslie, is there anything about the little baby or the royal family that you wanted to say before we take the break?
No, I'm just looking forward to having him grow up healthy and happy and hopefully under less scrutiny than the royals normally get. I doubt that'll occur, but I just want him to have his normal life as possible and as happy as possible.
Yeah, I agree with you there, but I will say one thing about this little baby. I thought the pictures of his parents, Kate and William, when they came out of the hospital and she was holding the baby, those pictures were just so absolutely beautiful. I think they're a beautiful couple, and they just looked so – it's almost like something out of a movie. I mean, that's how beautiful they look.
Yeah, I have to say, one of my favorite moments was when William put the baby in the car seat in the back of the car and drove off. I mean, how normal. And it was a great moment.
You're exactly right. I just go ahead, Barry.
Hey, I was just saying, it gives you an idea of why the royal family has such high popularity in Great Britain. The Queen has about a 90% approval rating.
Right.
And Prince William and Kate are right up there, too, because while they are royal and they comport themselves with tremendous dignity, they're also very down to earth and very likable in the case of Kate and Will. And I think that will guarantee the monarchy lasts for a very long time, hopefully well beyond our lifetime.
Yeah. No, I just thought that picture of her holding the baby and William and, you know, the taking the baby to the car, I think all of that was so beautiful that I think you're right, Barry. I think they're going to be a very popular – I just hope that you know, the as Leslie was saying, that the little kid has a chance to grow up privately and without the cameras. But, you know, some of that will be difficult to accomplish. Now, we're going to get into Detroit, guys, next. And I know both of you have your own personal stories of Detroit. So we're going to be doing that in the next segment. And before we get there, though, I want you to hear from something that my friend Aaron Clary sent me. This is a little thing that he did, and I want you to hear about Aaron Clary and Captain Capitalism.
Hello, everybody. This is Aaron Clary, a.k.a. Captain Capitalism. Say, when you're done reading Cubanos in Wisconsin, why don't you head on over to my place, captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, and take a look at a couple of the books I got. I got Worthless, The Young Person's Indispensable Guide for Choosing the Right Major. That's a must for every college-going kid or their parents. Then there's Enjoy the Decline, if you're kind of sad and depressed about where the country and the economy is going, and you feel kind of helpless about not being able to do anything about it. That is a must for you as well. Life is too short to let people like Barack Obama ruin it. We also have Behind the Housing Crash. That's an old one, but if you want to figure out what was going on behind the housing crash, there you go. And then Captain Capitalism Top Shelf. That is the best of Captain Capitalism. Don't bother scouring my website. Just go and buy the book. Save yourself a lot of time or money. You can find them all available on Amazon, both paperback and Kindle.
And we tell you that Aaron Clary's traveling up in Canada. That's what I've been watching in Facebook, all these pictures of Aaron traveling up in Canada. What are you hearing of Aaron, Leslie?
I am just enjoying his escapades through Alaska. Every day it's something awesome and beautiful, and he's obviously having a grand time. And I'm really excited for him because apparently he's just been invited to speak in Hong Kong.
Oh, wow. I saw that. That was very, very exciting. So, Aaron, if you're out there listening to us or you listen to the archives, we miss you, and hopefully you can join us next Thursday. But that's a really nice audio that Aaron put together about Captain Capitalism and his book. So let's talk about Detroit, guys, because I know both of you have personal memories of Detroit. Everybody knows the city has filed for bankruptcy. I think it's inevitable. There wasn't really anything else that the city could do. So, Leslie, you take it away. Your thoughts on Detroit, and then we'll get Barry in.
Well, you know, at this point, my major concern is how Detroit is going to get out of this hole. Because, yeah, you could blame the Democrats, and justifiably, and you can blame the unions, and yes, justifiably. But laying blame is not going to fix this problem. So my one wish is that somebody come up with a sensible game plan that can be applied to the city of Detroit, that isn't racist-based, that makes a good template, because you have to keep in mind that there are four other cities in California alone that have also declared bankruptcy. And whatever template that Detroit uses could be something to turn around other cities across the country. So I don't know what that is. I would hope that it's based on bringing entrepreneurs in, of getting rid of the race politics, of getting rid of the Republican versus Democrat, the conservative versus liberal, and the citizens of Michigan and the Detroit area coming together and resolving this whole mess, but also figuring out how to get the unions out of the power positions that they're in, but somehow preserve the pensions, or at least the portion of the pensions that people were promised. So it's a very complicated system. And I just think that it's important to start looking ahead instead of trying to place the blame at this point.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with you. There's no sense going back. I mean, I think you can only look forward at this point. But I've got some ideas about what they can do in the future. But I would like to hear from Barry. What are your thoughts, Barry?
Well, first, my involvement with Detroit began when I moved there in 1995. My wife was born in Detroit, and her family lived just on the outskirts, a place called Sterling Heights. Her father was pretty typical of what became the Detroit. Her father was born and raised in the downtown section when it was a fairly nice working class suburb of, you know, very close to the city. And he worked in the auto manufacturing sector for his entire career. Worked on a factory line for GM. Member of the United Auto Workers his whole life. And I learned a lot about what the problems of Detroit were through going to UAW rallies, in which people like Jimmy Hoffa, in fact, talked and spoke at, constant picnics with UAW members from the factory, and just following the local politics, and hearing his life story. And you really can see what happened was in the 1960s, things started to turn badly in the wrong direction. The population has dropped 60% since then. And what happened was this economic hub of America, the manufacturing heart of America, which got us through World War II and the Korean War, producing most of our military equipment. Anything that basically was driven was made in Detroit for the most part. What happened was a poisonous brew of trade unions and ethnic politics overtook the city, where you had a great influx of African Americans coming from the Deep South, moving to the city to find opportunities. And when 1968 comes along, you have the race riots. A lot of the white population, all working class blue collar workers, begin to move to the suburbs and to incorporate as cities outside of the 8 mile mark. The 8 mile road is what surrounds Detroit and demarks where the city limit is. And with them went the tax base. But you had the trade unions negotiating with the city for more and more benefits for their members. You had racial politics being a huge part, with really unqualified people taking place in the city government and aligning themselves with the trade unions to in that sort of political alliance where the politicians promise the moon in order to get votes. And those promises are worthless because they eventually can't be paid off, as we're seeing today. But it gets people elected. And whether it was Coleman Young or Dennis Archer, one mayor after another was incompetent and was basically demagogic. Their only claim to fame was they were demagogues. And the United All Workers and other unions just squeezed the city for everything it was worth, and the tax base was disappearing. And that's where you end up today, with a city that looks like it is just bombed out. I drove through Detroit in the 90s, and it looked like Dresden after World War II. The race riots has done tremendous damage. And they also had a thing called Devil's Night every Halloween, where gangs would roam through the streets burning buildings, burning houses down. And so you had these shells of these what were once beautiful brick houses that are just a shell today. And weeds growing everywhere, lots of open lots. And the whole place looks like a ghost town. And what's really scary, Sylvia, is that Detroit is just, you know, they're just on the forward edge of what could happen to the rest of the country. Minus the race riots, you have the same sort of economic, you know, situation in a lot of American cities with, politics aligning with the unions, the public service unions, to suck, you know, the cities or in some cases the states, like in California, just suck the state dry. And Detroit is right around the corner for all of us.
That's right. No, you're exactly right. They do have some unique problems that other cities don't have, but the basic problems that they have, you know, no taxpayers or driving the taxpayers out, all of that. I mean, yeah, they do. But what would you do to fix the problem? I mean, that's what I'm anxious to hear from both of you. I think we kind of know how we got here. But what would you do to fix the problem? Leslie, let me begin with you. What would you do?
You know, at this point, I would figure out how to encourage new business to come in, which means that new businesses would not pay taxes, any city taxes. I would go ahead and I'd declare bankruptcy and get rid of all my pension obligations. And I'm sorry if that you were depending on those pensions, people, but that's your fault for letting the leadership that you did that drained the city. So I think it's really bad and it's really sad, but when you choose the leadership that you do, you're going to have to pay a price. And I think those people who are depending on those legacy platinum benefits are just going to have to suck it up and feel the pain that the taxpayers have been feeling for the past couple of decades. That would be the first few things. But sadly, when you have a city council member who looks at a white person at a hearing and says they don't want to hear from that person because they are white, you are setting up a system that's full of fail, because that's disrespecting a significant portion of the population that would potentially be able to come in and help build businesses there. So how you get rid of race politics, I don't even begin to fathom. And until our communities begin to have that real resolution that they're not going to play the race cards again, I think Detroit's going to face real challenges.
Yes, I think you're exactly right, because that is one of the reasons they got in trouble, that kind of racial politics. Barry, what about you?
Well, Leslie covered some of the bases. I want to add in a couple more. First of all, Detroit has the highest per capita rate of violent crime of all the 25 largest cities in America, the highest. And that's the first thing you have to get a handle on, because you're not going to gentrify and clean up and attract basically upper middle class and upper class groups back to the city, downtown, until you do that, to get rid of the crime. A lot of it's gang-based. You see the same thing in Chicago. You have to have politicians who are willing to break some eggs in order to make the omelet. And right now it's all racial politics there, so you're not going to see it happen until that changes, sadly. You also have one-party rule, and I don't know how to fix this other than, again, gentrify the city and get people to move back in and start voting a different way. But you have, since 1960, you've had nothing but Democrats and mostly African-Americans running the city. And the results are right on the table. You have to have another party that offers a viable alternative. And Republicans haven't, and they won't until the ethnic diversity of that city is greater. So that's the next thing. So you've got to get rid of crime. You've got to attract a higher caliber of people into the city. And by the way, every city on the East Coast and the Midwest, the big cities, like Pittsburgh, for instance, and Newark, they all had riots in the 60s. They all had the race riots. And if you go to Pittsburgh, for instance, it's a beautiful city today. If you go to New York, downtown New York, I went there in the 70s. It was full of graffiti. It was filled with violent crime. I saw mugging happening right on the street while I was there. Times Square was full of pawn shops and prostitution and porno theaters. That was Times Square back in the 70s and 60s. And it took a strong mayor, Rudy Giuliani, to get rid of all that. And Detroit needs that desperately. They need strong leadership. And they're not going to get it from the current bunch that are running that city and have run for 40 years. So that's the third thing. They need strong leadership. And what I don't want to see is a bailout. And Leslie hit on this, and I think I always want to say it one more time. You get the government you deserve. The unions and the people of Detroit have voted themselves into this position. They are where they're at because they voted themselves there. There are no innocents here, except those who can't vote or are too young to have voted back in the past. But if you've been in Detroit for 40 years, you've been voting for the same bunch time and time again. Don't complain to the rest of the country that you're now bankrupt. You are there because you bankrupt yourself.
That's right.
So I think you have to go bankrupt and then restructure, get rid of those union contracts, bring in new leadership, gentrify that city. And I don't know if they can do that, Silvio. Frankly, I don't know if they haven't gone beyond the tipping point and will really recover.
Well, it's interesting, Leslie. If you remember last year, was it last year? Within the last 6 months, we had someone from Michigan talking about right to work. Remember that? Was it Michigan or Indiana?
It's my friend Lloyd, who will hopefully
be back
with us in a couple of weeks
to
chat about the Detroit situation. But, the state is separate from the city. You have to understand, in Michigan, it's a lot like California. You have the major city, Detroit, the metropolitan area, and that it's almost a separate country from the rest of the state, which is far more politically diverse, far more conservative, and actually far more economically healthy. And the part of Lloyd's challenge is to make sure that his sphere, because he's with the city government in a local community, the Detroit sphere stays around the Detroit area and doesn't encroach upon the much more economically healthy community. And part of the governor's challenge is to kind of keep the growth in the state going with this enormous drain on their resources. So it is very complex, especially since Detroit based its economy on the auto industry, and manufacturing has, you know, slowly gone by the wayside in this country because of a variety of reasons, include manufacturers who are punished with high taxes and a great deal of regulation.
Exactly.
If I could jump in here.
Yeah,
go
ahead.
Go ahead. Of the auto manufacturing. I know a lot of people worked in Detroit in the auto manufacturing sector, and I can remember being at a lot of these rallies and talking to these people. But being in the rallies, and they're always talking about a living wage. You know, they're demanding a living wage. But when you talk to these folks who work on the assembly lines, they're getting $25 to $30 an hour. They get mandated overtime, so they get time and a half. They can work any Saturday they want to get that overtime. They get a really generous pension system, and they get great health benefits, which all add up. So, you know, they basically made themselves not competitive with the rest of the world by having these really cushy jobs. And by the way, I don't think a $90,000 job, $90,000 a year job, is not a living wage. And that's what it essentially came down to. They were complaining that was not a living wage. They couldn't live on $90,000 a year, which a lot of them are making. Even if they're making $40,000 to $50,000 a year, that's pretty good for working on an assembly line where you get, you know, 3 or 4 hours of breaks throughout the day. I can remember hearing stories about the assembly line being closed down because they had to get a light bulb changed. And so everybody went to play cars and drink, you know, have a drink, you know, go outside for a drink or smoke. And you couldn't change the light bulb because only an electrician could change the light bulb under the union contract. So you had to wait until an electrician was available to walk onto the assembly floor and put on that light bulb. These are the kind of stupid things that are mandated in these contracts that needs to change. So unless the auto manufacturing industry completely streamlines itself and makes itself viable in an international market where we're competing against Chinese labor and Mexican labor and other places where they're getting paid, you know, just pennies on the dollar comparatively, Detroit can never make it. It has no chance.
Right. Well, it can never, it probably won't be like it used to be. I agree with that. I mean, it won't be like it was in the 40s or 1950s with, but there are things Detroit can do. It can re-engineer itself or diversify itself. I was reading a book by Henry Ford about 20 years ago, the biography of Henry Ford. And I went back and I looked at it again over the last few days because what was amazing about Detroit, if you go back 100 years ago, beginning of the 20th century, what you had in Detroit was all of these little shops that would came together, people who came with ideas and they were willing to risk their little capital that they had. But basically they attracted small entrepreneurs who became huge companies. And that, in a sense, is what Detroit needs to do. It needs to go back and say, Detroit is now going to be open for business. If you want to do business, if you want a good place to do business, like Leslie was saying, where the taxes are low, where we're going to exempt maybe some regulations, I would also exempt a lot of the small businesses maybe from minimum wage and simply say, look, you know, we're going to allow you to pay a little bit less than minimum wage if that's what it takes for you to get your business, you know, off the ground. We're going to exempt you from Obamacare if that ever gets implemented. In other words, I would make it so easy for people to do business in Detroit that within a short time there will be activity. Now, it won't be like before, but there will be activity and the city will begin to grow. I would also borrow an idea, and I don't know how many of you have been to Baltimore, Maryland, but in the early 1970s, I mean, Baltimore was just a disaster. And the mayor of the city basically put all the houses for sale for $1. You could just buy a house. If the house was empty, you could buy the property for $1 with a commitment that you would clean up the house, you would rebuild the house, and you couldn't sell it for like 10 years or so, all of a sudden you had all these young couples moving into Baltimore, and what was the big slums of Baltimore became beautiful townhomes that are now worth a lot of money. So those are just a couple of ideas to attract business and to attract taxpayers, because that's what the city has to do, guys. They have to attract taxpayers. Leslie, how about that?
I will simply point out, Sylvia, that there are homes in Detroit for less than $500 that you could buy. That's already being done. The element that Baltimore probably lacks, that Detroit has, that makes it so toxic, is the race politics. And, you know, and I'm sorry, it's time to have a national conversation that you cannot be anything other than black in that community and not be a target of some, you know, race hatred. And in that environment, who really wants to move? Even, you know, black people who want to do better in life want a community where there's real diversity and real tolerance. So,
and you're not going to get them back into the city, no matter what you offer in incentives, until you get a handle on crime. And Detroit, again, has got the highest crime rate, violent crime rate in the nation. And until you do something about that, you're not going to gentrify, because what you described there, Silvio, is gentrification. It's young couples, the yuppies or gay couples who spend money out of their own pocket to improve the real estate, you know, to make improvements. And they're not going to take that risk, especially if they're raising families. If you're moving into basically what's a ghetto today, a bombed out ghetto filled with gangs.
Yeah, well, and that's you're exactly right. Both of you are right, but I think Leslie, you are exactly right. We need to have a national conversation about race. We're seeing a little bit of that with this Zimmerman trial and the reaction by some of the race arsonists who are out there.
We've had a national conversation on race. It's time for the African Americans who are blaming whites on their problems to face the fact that it's, as Barry mentioned, crime, but crime because there's no family structure, there's no value on education, there's no value on anything that's healthy and non-victim oriented. And until the black community can go ahead and have that dialogue and start fixing problems internally, there's no other race, no other group of people can fix their problems for them. And while they make that toxic environment, no other person or no other community is going to go in and to a black-dominated community willingly. And even if you have free houses and no taxes, you have to have an environment where people, all people of any race, will thrive. And Detroit can't offer that now. And until they do, you're going to see deterioration. And though I hope it changes. I was there myself until I graduated from Wayne State University. I fled there because I realized there would be no opportunity for me to really be successful, and I found that opportunity in California. So I hope the state of Michigan comes together with the city of Detroit and gets a game plan that works for them. I would be really amazed to see what it is and would love to see where they are 20, 30 years from now when King George takes his throne.
That's right. That's right. We'll have King George go to Detroit. That will be his first American visit. That would be kind of cool.
What would be really fun for me to see is a descendant of George W. Bush go to that coronation.
Yes, that would be nice. That would be nice. And say, hello, brother. How are you?
Yeah.
That would be nice. There is, by the way, there is a George P. Bush, who is a nephew of the president and a grandson of the other president, of the first President Bush. And there's some talk about George P. Bush running for office here in Texas. He's a very dynamic young man. He doesn't look at all like his uncle or like his grandfather. He looks more like his mother. And I'm talking about Jeb Bush's son. So interesting young man. But we're going to have to wrap it up, guys. Leslie, what's our any hint on some schedules?
Yes, I've got some exciting news for you. We have talked and I've confirmed with an author, Bruce Woodhull, who is going to be discussing the Native American Mafia with us on the next Thursday show. And my compatriot at college's direction, Al Stair, is going to be back on, and we're going to bring you up to speed on what's happening on college campuses. Later on in August, Barry will be back with us to discuss the Battle of Actium, where the forces of Antony and Cleopatra met the navy of Rome under Octavian, and everything that fell out there. And I'm also doing some marketing with a new dance studio, so I'm hoping to have the dance instructor come on and share with us a little Bollywood background, as well as maybe a look at the history of India with Barry. So still working
Great.
On some things, but the next few weeks are going to be a lot of fun and a whole a wide array of topics.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to that, Barry and Leslie. Barry, very quickly, tell us about yourself. I know I should have done it at the top of the show, but just give us a quick a one-minute bio on Barry.
Well, I'm a Special Forces operator, no longer, but I was at one time, working with in three different continents with U.S. Army Special Forces. I was a combat medic on a scuba team, as well as a light weapons expert. My entire life had a fascination with ancient and medieval combat. I've been a reenactor training with medieval weapons and medieval armor since 1975, I guess, and is still doing that. One of those projects was the Spartan Warband, where I reenacted the Spartans. And through that, I got a job working in television with the show Deadliest Warrior on Spike TV. I was the Spartan expert on the pilot. And later went on to be, once the show actually got picked up, I went on to be the historical advisor for the show and one of the producers in the second season. It was the most successful show in the history of Spike TV, so we're very proud of that. A real fun show. Now I blog and write. My book, The Age of Arthur, will be coming out this fall, and I blog at Deadliest Blogger, my military history blog. And at Word Warrior of SoCal. Also, you can find me on Facebook, where I have a military history page. So there you have
it. That's right. And we have a link to your main blog on the show information. So that should be there for anybody who wants to click. And, of course, Leslie is our Thursday co-host, and we always have a lot of fun with Leslie. Now that you're back, Leslie, it's going to be a lot of fun these Thursday nights with you and with Barry when he joins us. But thank you so much to both of you for joining me tonight, and I hope both of you have a wonderful evening in the West Coast, and we'll talk next week with Barry, and very soon, I hope, with you, Barry. Good night to both of you.
Take care, Silvio.
All right, good night to both of you. Well, that's going to do it for tonight. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and I hope you have a wonderful evening. Good night, everybody.
Good night.